Welcome to the Film Experience Podcast. This is your host, Murtada El-Fadl, and I am with my partner, Nathaniel Rogers.
Hi.
We took a week off, but we're back. I was responsible for that week off because I was on the jury of New Fest, and I was watching lots of fantastic movies, but unfortunately they're not in release, so if we talked about them, you know, you wouldn't be able to say much. But we're back.
Well, but we have to know your general experience with that. This was your virgin jury festival, right?
Yes, it was a fantastic experience. I was very impressed by the breadth of movies, queer stories, different genres from all over the world. The particular jury that I was on was the narrative features jury, and we had 17 movies, and I saw things like animated movie from Sweden, a romantic comedy from the Philippines. It was just a really amazing experience. And the movie that we gave our grand jury prize to is a Guatemalan movie called Temblores, directed by Jairo Bustamante. And that movie is actually opening in New York at the Quad late November. So if you guys are in New York, go see it. It's amazing. It was a unanimous choice. Such a fantastic movie. Tells a very particular queer story. So very tacky was our choice.
Is this the director of Ixcanul?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
Yeah, it's his.
So if any of you saw that Guatemalan Oscar submission from a few years back, which actually did decent business in U.S. art houses.
Yeah.
So he has another movie out, and this time it's queer. Apparently.
Yes.
News to me, though.
Well, it's coming out, so I hope everybody can check it out. And New Fest is just amazing. Their programming is so great. I was just, you know, when you go to these movies, they play short movies before, and even in the short movies, it's just stories about so many things, all queer experiences from all over the world. It's just amazing programming.
I only went to one this year, but I went to an encore presentation of And Then We Danced, which is Sweden's Oscar submission, and I love that movie so much. I cannot stop recommending it to people.
And
it's way up there. It's way up there with Parasite and Pain and Glory for me this year under the international cinema.
Oh, that's fantastic! And that movie won the Audience Award, so it is one of the big prize winners.
Yeah, and I did have an opportunity to interview the director, so that will be on the site a little later.
Fantastic. We'll look forward to that. But today we are mainly talking about Martin Scorsese's The Irishman, which is the big release this week. I mean, if you can call it a big release, since it's only in New York and L.A., I think. But it will be on Netflix soon, and everybody can see it.
Yeah, right.
Did you see this movie at Middleburg?
I did, yeah. It was the closing selection at Middleburg. So I saw it in a not necessarily that comfortable chair. But I will say this for the movie. Everyone knows my aversion to very long movies. I didn't really mind the running time. I was pleasantly sort of involved the whole time. I would never claim that I don't think it could have lost 20 minutes, but it didn't really bother me the way I thought it might, given the absurd length.
Yeah, I agree. And the thing with Scorsese movies, I mean, his movies are always long. This is not new. Like, his shortest movie is probably 2.5 hours. So it's nothing new for him, but there's always something happening on screen in a Scorsese movie. Like, yes, it's 3.5 hours, but it's not like he's taking 10 minutes to just follow some meditative shot in the plains or whatever. Something is happening. People are talking. There's action. There's camera. You can't but look at the screen. Like, I never lose or, you know, go into dreams while in a Scorsese movie because so much is happening all the time. And this is why I like the movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I was pleasantly surprised given that I was just like, oh, another mob drama. You know, I was one of those people. And there are things that I definitely don't like about the movie, but overall, I thought it was a quite involving, and like you're saying, like the craft with Scorsese pictures, even if you don't, even if you aren't naturally drawn to their themes or subject matter or, you know, plot or genre, like a mob movie, there's always something that's easy to latch onto about his movies. And I was actually thinking about his long collaboration with the editor Thelma Schoonmaker, while I'm not sure if I'm saying her name right. But I was thinking about her a lot during this movie because the pacing is really great considering, you know, and editing has so much to do with that, you know, whether or not you stay invested in a movie.
Yeah.
And it reminded me of that quip that she had made this very famous quip from around like Raging Bull time, I think, where people were asking her like, how do you feel about always working on such violent movies? And she's like, they're not violent before I cut them.
That is so great.
So she's a very, very sharp editor. And even though I think his movies have a little bit of filler in them, she makes them move regardless.
Yeah, absolutely. And this one really does move. So The Irishman is the story of this Frank Sheeran, who's an alleged mafia hitman, the big thing, he did this and as told to book, so he told it to the writer. The book is called I Heard You Paint Houses, and the reason that the book is controversial is because he claims to know what happened to Jimmy Hoffa, and the movie tells that story. But the interesting part is also just the intersection of unions with mafia and all structures of American society. And it takes a long period. That's why it's 3.5 hours, because it starts in the 50s and it goes well into the 70s. So Robert De Niro's Frank Sheeran and Al Pacino's Jimmy Hoffa, and Joe Pesci is another mafioso, Russell Bufalino.
And less discussed, but still in the movie, it's another reunion, Harvey Keitel.
Yes. Very small part, though.
Very small part, but I was just like, oh, well, like, can we talk about him, too? It's like, why is the publicity only these three when Harvey Keitel's a major part of the Scorsese filmography as well?
He is. But maybe because his part is, like...
Yeah. You
know. And the thing is, there is a lot of this with Scorsese. Everybody obviously wants to work with him, so they will take parts they probably won't take with other directors. So... You have somebody like
Anna Paquin, say.
Anna Paquin. But the name now escapes me, I can't believe. The guy who was in Blue Jasmine and in Vinyl, what's his name?
Bobby Cannavale.
Bobby Cannavale. Which is also has a very small part, and it's like, why are you doing this part? And but anyway, it's filled.
Although maybe those are bad examples, because I think Bobby and Anna both say yes to basically everything that's offered them. They're both always in things. No offense. Some actors are just like that, you know. I don't think it's out of desperation. I think some people just really love to always be working, even if the part is not much.
Yeah. And who wouldn't be on a Scorsese set for like a month or two? Like, come on. If I was Bobby Cannavale, I would say yes.
Well, and he fits right into that repertory company.
Yeah. And so the thing that people have been talking about, of course, is the special effects, the de-aging, which is why this movie is so expensive and why it's at Netflix. And the de-aging kind of works and kind of doesn't work. For me, it was fine, and I understood the decision to de-age older actors because the last part of the movie is about the effects of this life of crime on this aging mafioso guy. So if they had, I don't know, cast Bobby Cannavale and then aged him up, it would not have the same effect as casting Robert De Niro in his late 70s and you see everything on his face and then de-aging him for the first part of the movie. So the decision is completely correct, because it adds such gravitas and pathos to the last hour when De Niro is really old. But also, he's 76, and when he's playing a 30-year-old and trying to kill people and doing all those action scenes, it's not...
I would say it's not convincing.
It's not but it didn't take me out of the movie, but his body moves like a 76-year-old man, and that's where you're just like, okay, you're not 35. But
yeah,
the face,
yeah, that was the issue I had with it.
Yeah.
That is exactly the issue I had with it, where, like, because Joe Pesci is de-aged as well, and it's like, and he's in his, he's also in his, like, late 70s, and it just, they don't move. Like, it's kind of how they talk about how animation, mm-hmm. you know, it's easy to animate animals, but when you're animating people, you instinctively know when movements don't look right.
Yep.
And it's something you don't even think about, at least I never think about the way older people move differently than the younger people. I've literally, like, almost never thought about this. But I kept thinking about it during this movie, so it did take me out of the movie a little bit, because it just, like, I was like, why are they walking so strangely? Because they have, like, these younger faces.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, it's just because they're filming older actors and de-aging mm-hmm. their faces.
Yeah.
And so for me, I did find it distracting. I especially hated whatever was going on with Robert De Niro's eyebrows in the movie. So I did find the de-aging very distracting. Even though, yes, technical marvel that they can do this to people, and, you know, we've been seeing it in other movies before this. I didn't think the thing that surprised me about this one, given the all the stories about how expensive it was that it didn't necessarily look better to me than any other examples of de-aging I've seen in like superhero movies, for example.
Yeah. I actually had to watch The Curious Case of Benjamin Button recently, because I did an episode on it on my Cate Blanchett podcast. And I have to say, that was a decade ago, and probably the de-aging and aging up and backwards or whatever it is in that crazy movie looks better than The Irishman. So the technology hasn't really progressed that far.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember that, like, the first time watching Benjamin Button, and just like, oh my God, you know, seeing like young Brad Pitt, I guess.
Yeah.
I mean, that was like 10, 12 years ago now or something. And, you know, and Brad's aged a lot, cause he's like now in the past 10 years, but even then he didn't look like Thelma and Louise Brad anymore. So it was like,
mm-hmm.
I just remember the sort of the shock of seeing him look like Thelma and Louise Brad during Benjamin Button.
He looks so much better than Robert De Niro looks as a younger man in The Irishman.
Yeah. And maybe that has to do with, like, de-aging someone who's in their, you know,
40s 30s. Rather than their 70s. Yeah. Yeah.
Right. But regardless, I found it distracting in the movie, which was unfortunate, because, like, the story is really involving and the filmmaking is really involving. But I have to give a shout out to Al Pacino, because, like, I don't know if they had to do anything with him or whatever, but he was so entertaining. I never once was thinking about anything other than the movie while watching his scenes. I was completely in them.
Yes. I agree wholeheartedly. And I think he benefits from the fact that Jimmy Hoffa appears later in the story, and maybe the first time he appears, he's not supposed to be 30, he's maybe supposed to be 50. So that definitely helps him. But he was my takeaway too. He's very entertaining. It plays it to the hilt. It's an Al Pacino performance that you expect, because mm-hmm. we've seen him do it, but he does it so fantastic. It's so great. Very entertaining. So funny. He's so great. He is my favorite in the film.
Yeah, mine too, easily. Like, and I know I've mentioned this before, or maybe only in my head. I always feel like I'm repeating myself, but I think it's because a lot of things I want to say on the blog, I don't actually say on the blog. I just say to myself over and over at home. Like, I should write an article about this. But Joe Pesci and Al Pacino, the interesting thing about those two performances side by side is Joe Pesci is doing, like, the exact opposite of what you might expect him to do when he returns. Because he's doing this very sort of, like, stoic, internalized performance.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Al Pacino is doing exactly what you would expect. And that usually playing against type is more, like, sort of exciting in terms mm-hmm. of awards campaigns or whatever. But Al Pacino, it's like seeing him do what he does best again at the level he used to do it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these big showy thing was very, very exciting to watch.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I just loved his performance, like, from the first scene to the last scene with him.
Yeah.
I could see him winning, I guess.
I could too. He is really great. And I think he's also excited, I guess, by working with De Niro again, by working with Scorsese for the first time. You're just seeing him really being so excited every time he's on screen. And the role just fits him like a glove. And he's just like, okay, you got me this great part and I'm going to go and I'm going to do everything. And it's a joy to watch. Even though he's playing this terrible, terrible person, Jimmy Hoffa.
Yeah. I mean, we haven't talked about Anna Paquin at all because, in truth, she has, like, the tiniest part imaginable. She just gets to look concerned at various points, or concerned and disappointed are the two modes.
Yeah.
But I even liked her better when it involved Pacino. Like,
yeah,
I think he livens up the whole movie because she, in the movie, like, the only real part she has in the movie, because, like, her big dramatic scene is played by a younger actress, not de-aged Anna Paquin playing a 10-year-old or whatever, but an actual 10-year-old. So all of what you see of her as an adult is sort of like this, like, detached daughter who doesn't want to be involved with her father. So it's all these like looks, you know. She doesn't have much dialogue. And she's mostly paired with either Joe Pesci or Al Pacino, because it's showing the way she reacts to those two major figures in her father's life. And so I, like, whenever she was with Al Pacino, I was, like, really into it.
Yeah, I have to say that part is my biggest disappointment with the film, because it is a narrative thread of the story. Sheeran's relationship with his daughter, and how basically he scarred her for life when he tried to protect her by beating up a man who disrespected her when she was a kid. And it's a narrative thread that's in the whole of the film. But I kept expecting, especially by hiring Anna Paquin, an Oscar winner, that this would come to fruition at some point in the movie and we'll see a confrontation, we'll see anything happening between them. But it doesn't. And I know this is not what the movie is about, but it is a narrative thread that they put in. And it's disappointing that it doesn't come to anything in the end. All she does is just look scared for the rest of the film and disappointed. And there was something there to be, even if it didn't happen in real life. This is not a documentary. Mm-hmm. There is something there that they could have done with this part.
I agree, and I would even go further. I would say it is kind of what the movie's about, because so much of the movie is about. I think so much of the movie is supposed to be about his remorse at his life.
Yeah,
because you're seeing him very old at the end. Well, not really at the end, sort of all through, because it's kind of narrated. Also, that didn't work for me, the framing device. but regardless. and I felt like it was such a crucial part of why he was such a lonely figure at the end. The fact that he did not have this this major familial touchstone that he needed. That I think a scene between the two of them, like, resolving that by not resolving it, you know, by showing her anger for him or whatever, would have really, really gone a long way to making the movie better than it was, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And the last part of the film is really, it's why I love De Niro in this movie, like, and why I forgive Scorsese for the de-aging, because the last part of this declining mafioso looking back at his life, you needed somebody in his late life, an actor in his late life, to play it. And De Niro is great in those scenes where he's trying to connect with his daughter, where he's trying to just find something to hang on to, that sort of explains his life or gives his life worse. And it is something that everybody would deal with late in life. And it's very touching, and the performance is really, really great in those scenes. And why I forgave the aging and also the 3.5 hour long. Because you needed his whole life story to sort of get to that point where you sort of understand why he's so reflective of what has happened.
Yeah. And while we're talking about his life story, can I just express my absolute dismay that the movie is not called I Heard You Paint Houses?
Such a great title.
It's such a great title, and it's the actual book title, and it's very, very important to the movie.
Mm-hmm. And they even show it.
Yeah, they even show it in a big title font. It's the only time a big title font comes up. And I'm so perplexed why they have such a generic title when they had this thing that makes you think of, like, 70s classics, like Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore, mm-hmm. or They Shoot Horses, Don't They, in 69, or whatever. Like, these movies that had these, like, titles that you'll just never forget.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's on Netflix, so it's not like they wanted a generic title for the box office.
Right. Yeah, I was just mystified by that decision.
Yeah, such an amazing title.
Like, the fact that he's an Irishman, it's mentioned in the movie, but it's so not important to the movie.
No. It is the thing that sort of makes him stand out from the rest because everybody else is Italian. But, yeah, it's not that important.
Right, but even that doesn't really work because they have to put blue contact lenses on Robert De Niro, you know? So it's just, like, it's a little annoying. I found it a little annoying.
Yeah. So I mean, they could have just made him Italian and didn't even give him the blue contact lenses. Like, it's fine. I think there are some Irish people with dark eyes. I don't know. Maybe. I'm not the expert.
Yeah. So, yeah. But, yeah, so I like this movie more than I expected to, if it is not remotely near my top 10. Not remotely. So I'll just have to go, okay, when it gets nominated for all the Oscars.
I think it's essential within Scorsese's filmography. I think he builds on themes that he knows well and he's explored in Casino and in Goodfellas. It did irk me at the beginning that I thought it was just like Goodfellas, the voiceover, the outsider Irishman coming into the Italian family, even like the scene that we talked about with the younger Anna Paquin is very reminiscent of that scene in Goodfellas where he beats up the guy who disrespects Lorraine Bracco. So there is a lot of familiar things, but as the movie like just went on, it becomes something different. And so it's a deeper examination of these scenes that Scorsese is obviously concerned with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I respect Scorsese, but I guess I just don't feel... I don't feel like personally attached to his filmography, if that makes sense. Like, I love a few of his movies, but he's never been someone that I feel like that his movies are part of my life, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
The way, like, say, Almodovar, because I think the closest comparison this year is Pain and Glory. It's like a director revisiting all the things he does.
Mm-hmm. And Tarantino.
And Tarantino. And of those three movies, I would say The Irishman's my least favorite of those three, but I think they're good. They're an interesting, I'll just say that they're a very interesting trio of movies in terms of, I think, even understanding what it's like to be an auteur. To have all of your movies be somehow personal expressions as opposed to, you know, director for hire.
Yeah. And, you know, Scorsese, like, earned this. Like, most of his movies are entertaining, and I always enjoy my time when I'm watching them, and this is no exception.
Yeah. So, I think we need to talk about the supporting actor category.
Let's do it. So is it Al versus Brad? Can you imagine? That's such a big star.
Yeah.
Supporting actor.
And they're both such huge parts. Like, yeah. Al Pacino is definitely a supporting actor in the Irishman, but he's such a major part of the movie that it almost feels like a leading role, but he's really only in, like, he comes into it later on, and it's really more about Robert De Niro is the only lead, per se, but...
Yeah, and he disappears, because, you know, just like Hoffa disappeared in real life.
Right, but he's, like, the storyline is so much about Jimmy Hoffa in a way, too, that it almost feels like a leading role, but in this case, it is supporting, but I just watched, like, literally last night, just watched Once Upon a Time in Hollywood again, and I don't believe that Brad is supporting in it, but, you know... Because I think I was surprised the second time through how even Margot Robbie's role felt much bigger to me the second time through.
But, I mean, is it this because these movies are so long? Like, it is 3.5 hours for The Irishman. So, yes, Jimmy Hoffa appears for 2 of those or something like that, which is more than somebody would, a supporting actor would appear in a two-hour movie. And
for
the same
sure.
for Once Upon a Time. They're such long movies. I think Brad is supporting. The movie is about, what's his name? Leonardo DiCaprio.
Rick Dalton.
He is supporting him within the story, and his story is always the B story. It's not the A story. So I think it's a fine...
I mean, I want to be convinced.
Supporting is great.
I want to be convinced because I would like to hand him a medal. But I'm just not sure I'm convinced that he's not, you know, a lead. But anyway, but Al Pacino's supporting.
Yeah.
So if it could be Brad versus Al... Yeah. Which would be two great performances,
mm-hmm.
and if it's going to be one or the other, I'm okay either way.
Yeah, I am too. I think Brad is amazing, and it's same as Al. They are two actors doing what they do best on screen. When it's such contrast to each other, you know, Pacino is loud and big and crazy and screaming and being funny, and Brad is more like just sexy and
being cool, laid
and
back,
quiet,
chill.
And like, yeah,
star magnetism.
Yeah, so it's so different, but it plays to both their strengths, and they're such star parts.
Yeah.
And maybe that's the thing, you know, supporting actor category is not supposed to be about stars, but in this case, it is.
Yeah. Well, because, like, the other one that might be here is Willem Dafoe, and I know you haven't seen The Lighthouse yet, so we're not going to really discuss it on this podcast, but that is a – I don't think people realize it's a two-person movie. There are literally two characters. For people who haven't seen The Lighthouse yet, Robert Pattinson and Willem Dafoe are the movie. If you know anything about lighthouses, of course, they're completely isolated from the world. And they're running this, there's just no other characters. And so it's a duet movie. One is not supporting. It's a duet movie. They're both always on screen. So that's irking me a little, that supporting campaign. But
do you think
he's
going to get nominated?
For a while I thought for absolutely sure, but now it's getting, both male acting categories are getting super competitive. It's tough to say if those recent nominations for Dafoe are telling of his sort of how much people enjoy him in the industry, then I think yes. If they were really just about his performances, then maybe not, because this movie is very weird.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I haven't seen it, so I can't say much, but he is very popular. It would be his third consecutive nomination.
Yeah. And then we have Tom Hanks in A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood. So this is going to be like the starriest supporting actor lineup in forever, regardless of who gets nominated. And then Joe Pesci, as we discussed. Then you have like sort of like the maybes, like Sterling K. Brown or I forget his name briefly. Kelvin Harrison Jr.
From Waves. Yep.
From Waves.
Kelvin.
Harrison Jr. Then you have Alan Alda, Marriage Story. Anthony Hopkins, The Two Popes, is another one like The Lighthouse, where it's a duet movie. I can sort of see more why people would say that Anthony Hopkins is supporting than Willem Dafoe is supporting, but it's still, nevertheless, it's a duet movie. But Anthony Hopkins is very good in it, The Two Popes.
But I know you like Category Frog is your thing, so you should give props to Christian Bale and Matt Damon going lead in Ford v. Ferrari.
Yeah, I love it. I love it. I wish it meant that Tracy Letts had some room as the actual supporting actor in the movie, but it's one of these years where it's like so star-driven.
But his movie gave him room, at least. Maybe the other movies are not giving him room, but his movie gave him room.
Yes, it definitely did. So... props to Christian Bale for refusing to be called supporting for a movie that he headlines. So every once in a while, someone does the right thing. Every once in a while. And then I, like, some people say Taiki Waititi for Jojo Rabbit or, there's a bunch more. John Lithgow for Bombshell, although I can't even with those prosthetic makeups in the trailer. I haven't seen Bombshell yet, but his the makeup work on him horrified me. So
seems very subdued. Like, the movie is really screaming hard. Neither of us have seen it yet, although I am seeing it very soon. But the buzz seems to be about Margot and Charlize, and nobody's talking about him at all, which is surprising because you would think Roger Ailes, he would be the one that talked about.
Yeah, because it was originally called the Untitled Roger Ailes movie.
Yeah.
So, but I guess he's not as central as even the smallest role for the three women. Yeah. So,
the one that I think you have really low, and I don't know if you saw Just Mercy, and I haven't seen it, but I feel like Jamie Foxx is really working the circuit, and he is popular and funny and somebody who maybe would run a great campaign and come in, but what do you think? Why do you have him so low in your tier three?
I have seen the movie, so that is why. It's more about the movie itself. My general theory of like Oscar campaigns is like if you're the lead, you can work with like a movie that's not great, like Renee Zellweger for Judy, as long as the role is really great. But I think for the most part, I think supporting campaigns require more support from the actual movie. Mm-hmm. Like, you get a lot of people where they're nominated because the movie's popular.
Yes.
Where you're kind of like, well, that they were good, but like, really, a nomination for that? Whereas like these showy parts in movies that aren't particularly exciting or good, I think it requires. I mean, if he gets nominated, it's entirely because of what you're saying. He's a star, and he's good at campaigning. Yeah. He's good in the movie, but it's just like the movie is very sort of. I don't know. I don't want to say flat, but it just isn't really. It's not exciting in any way, which was frustrating because I wanted it to be good. It felt very, very old-fashioned to me, like an old-fashioned inspirational courtroom drama.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you in that it's hard to get a nomination as supporting as the movie's only nomination, and we found out especially in the last few years with several people that it doesn't happen.
Yeah.
So if that's its only chance at a nomination, then I agree with why you're putting it so low.
Yeah, I mean, because like the two stars of the movie, so to speak, are Michael B. Jordan, who's way overdue for an Oscar nomination, and Brie Larson. But both of them, like Brie Larson's part is actually smaller than Jamie Foxx's, and Michael B. Jordan's part is like, I've nominated him a few times at the Film Pitch Awards. Like, I love him as an actor. But his part is like the least exciting in the movie, which is weird because he's the lead. He's sort of like the sort of audience surrogate to go through these stories, but it's not really an exciting part in any way. I didn't find, but Jamie Foxx has the best character and the best performance. So it's possible. I just think it's too competitive this year.
Yeah, it is. And so let's talk about Alan Alda a little bit, because we both saw Marriage Story, and he's so great. And that movie has so many edges, and he is the opposite of that. He is the warm presence, the funny man in this. It's such a small part that's why he probably won't get nominated. But he is the opposite of what everybody else is doing. They're all hard edges and going big and speeches. And he's just a warm, funny presence in his scenes. And I think that's maybe why he would get nominated, because he's so different than the other actors.
Yeah, and plus he's just great in it. And even what you're saying about him, which is completely true, it is part of the plot. You know, like the way his story develops, his tiny little story within the movie, you know, because, you know, everybody's talking about like whether or not lawyers are aggressive, or, you know, how good the lawyers are in divorce cases. It is about how like vicious they are, basically. I would love Alan Alda. So Alan Alda and Tracy Letts to me are like what I look for in supporting performances. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying they'll both make my list, because I still haven't seen a lot of movies, but that's exactly what I look for in supporting. It's like they enrich the movie, but the movie's not about them.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So I'm really a huge fan of both of those, and they're both completely supporting parts. doubt about it.
And, like, all in all, it's just so nice. Like, at the New York Film Festival premiere of Marriage Story, and they all came, and they were asking them questions. It's just, like, once he started talking, the whole room changed. It just became warmer, a nicer place to be in, because, you know, Noah Baumbach is prickly, and Adam Driver doesn't want to talk. And I don't know, Scarlett was late. And I just feel like if these people go into the room together, Alan Alda would win the campaign.
And we have to remember he did get nominated for a very small part in The Aviator,
which he was great in, too. Yeah,
I mean, yeah, but remember, that was kind of a surprise.
It was, yeah.
Even though the movie was the front runner at that point.
Yes, it was a surprise.
And then the two people we haven't mentioned on the big chart, Aldous Hodge from Clemency, who I know you're a huge fan of.
So amazing. I still have not seen that. You have to see it, Nathaniel. He's very deserving.
And then I don't know if you've seen Dolomite Is My Name. I just watched it a few days ago. And Wesley Snipes is awesome. He's so fun.
I was not a fan of Wesley Snipes. No, I'm a fan of the film. I think Eddie Murphy's amazing and so funny, and it's such a funny movie, and it's on Netflix. Just put it on. You'll have a great 2 hours. It's such a fun movie. But I thought Wesley Snipes was one note, and it wasn't a particularly interesting note.
Interesting. I really went for him. Like, I couldn't put a bead on what he was doing that was so entertaining to me, but I thought he was so much fun in that movie. Although that is also a much smaller part than you'd think.
He
doesn't show up for a really, really long time, and then he's very little of it after that.
And he keeps doing the same thing over and over. He's just exasperated with everyone. And just like,
you're not supposed to talk me out of loving him in this way. Just kidding. And we'll give a shout out to, he's no longer on the chart because the buzz has died, but Happy Gotham breakthrough nomination for Jonathan Majors, who's so great in Last Black Man in San Francisco.
Yes, he is so amazing. Literally at Sundance, I was like, he's going to win the Oscar. But, you know, that was a long time ago.
almost a full year. And then another early year person who I think was great and so deserving, John Turturro and Gloria Bell. I loved him in that movie, even though the character is so horrible.
He's great. He's very good
at the movie. But you know, you need more than just being great in a movie to get Oscar nominated. Sadly.
I mean, the person who I see is, and I'm surprised by this, is really campaigning as Shia LaBeouf for Honey Boy, and he is playing his dad, and he wrote the screenplay. He's pressing the flesh. Is that something? I haven't seen the movie, so I don't know. Is that something that's going to happen?
I think that depends on if people respond to the movie. And since I don't know if it just came out or if it's about to come out. I don't remember the release date.
Coming out next week, yes.
Okay. I thought it was good. But I don't know. Like, he's good in it. I've always thought Shia LaBeouf was a good actor, though, even when people hated him. Like, I've usually thought he was very good in his movies. And so I think he's good in it, but it's like it reminded me a little bit, this is going to sound like an insult, and I don't mean it this way. It reminded me of Edward Norton in Motherless Brooklyn. You're acting with a capital A. Like, you're very excited to have this part. You know, that sort of, like, the effort shows, you know? Mm-hmm.
Sometimes those performances are great. Just because it's effortful doesn't mean it's not good, yeah.
Well, yeah, that's why I said I don't mean this to sound insulting, because, like, side note, I really thought Edward Norton was bad in Motherless Brooklyn.
Oh, yeah, totally. We don't even have to talk about that.
I think he really needs a director. He should not direct himself. That's what I'm saying.
But Shia is good.
Yeah, Shia's very good in the movie, but yeah, and he's not directing himself, he just wrote himself.
Yes.
And he also has, like, a great scene partner in Noah Jupe, who's amazing all the time, that little kid. And And then Lucas Hedges is also in Honey Boy playing Shia LaBeouf as, like, an adult.
Mm.
And that's weird because he doesn't really have scenes with Shia LaBeouf.
Mm.
So it's a weird, like, trifurcated movie. Like, there's three major performances in it, but it's to me it was all about Noah Jupe, because, like, the camera's really invested in him the whole time. Like, he's this child star. It's sort of like, it is Shia's story, essentially.
Yeah.
And you really feel for him because you realize, oh my god, that would be like a horrible way to grow up, you know, on sets and having this very sort of unstable home life, and then you don't really have any power because, you know, you don't do the things regular kids do, but you are the money earner for your family, but yeah, the money's not yours. It's very, like, so I, like, we've seen other things about, oh, the poor child star before, like, every story about Judy Garland goes into it.
Totally.
But this one I thought was more affecting because it really dug it, like, it really made you think about the day-to-day, because it's really not a big story. It's really, really about this experience of growing up in this very strange way where, like, you're earning money for your whole family and, like, your family's a complete mess and your dad's probably an alcoholic and all these other things, you know? So, yeah, I thought he was really good in it, and he is, but it wasn't my favorite performance in the movie, and I think my suspicion is people are going to respect it but find it a little indulgent.
Mm. So Noah Jupe is your favorite performance?
Yeah, yeah.
Are they campaigning everybody supporting?
I don't actually know.
And Shia was in The Peanut Butter Falcon this year, which is another movie, yes, that surprisingly is very popular and made a lot of money. It's, I think, the most, yes, successful indie of the year, and he's really good in that too.
Yeah, I mean, it could just be a moment for him, so we'll, mm-hmm, see if Honey Boy does good business. It doesn't have to be great business, but if it doesn't, like, fall flat, mm-hmm, with audiences, maybe that could happen.
Yeah.
Because it is very, like, it has a lot of, like, hooks narrative for Oscar narratives, and the performance has a lot of hooks too, because alcoholism, desperation, all these things, you know?
Yeah. And back to where we originated, you still think Joe Pesci is, and Al Pacino are both getting in, right? I think so.
I think so, but it wouldn't surprise me if Joe Pesci doesn't get in, just because it's not... I mean, it all depends on if Irishman is, like, one of these across-the-board things.
Yeah, which we can talk about, too. I mean, do you see... Do you have it in for picture and director and...
I do, yeah, yeah. I personally wish it wouldn't take up so much room because, like, my preference is to spread the wealth and, like... Al Pacino's the best part of the movie, so nominate him for sure. But it doesn't mean everything else should be nominated. Like, I really, really don't think Robert De Niro should be nominated. He has some fine moments in the movie, but that category is so competitive. And if he gets in because the movie's popular, that's going to annoy me. Because that's such a rich category this year, which is so weird for me to say, but it's true. Best,
I mean, male. Like, I'm looking at best actor and who you have top, like, yes, he's not better than Banderas or Driver, but in your top five, I haven't seen Jonathan Pryce or Christian Bale, but I would nominate De Niro over Joaquin Phoenix and definitely over Taron Egerton. So I would not be as mad if he gets nominated, because I was really affected by the last hour of the movie and how amazing he is as the older Sheeran.
Yeah. I mean, as I was saying, I was at Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, an event where Leo and Brad and Margo were live streamed into theaters to discuss the movie.
Oh, Leo's amazing. I love him.
Yeah, he's great. And it's like the most I've liked Leo since The Departed.
Yes.
So I would be very happy if he showed up again, which is so weird for me, because usually when he's nominated, I'm like, yeah, yeah. Because to me, his nominations are weird. Like, Blood Diamond, I think he's bad in, like, and The Revenant, why win for that? I don't get it. But I would be happy if he showed up, but...
He is good. I agree with you, yes. I would be happy to.
But what I'm And I would be fine with Eddie Murphy showing up. I would love Taron Egerton to show up, even though I don't think he will. I don't need Robert De Niro in there. He already has 7 nominations and 2 wins, and I just don't think it's that great of a performance. Because I really fear it's going to come at the expense of Antonio Banderas.
That would be unfortunate. But I think if Antonio, Leo, Robert De Niro, and Adam Driver are all nominated, I'll be happy. And maybe Eddie Murphy in the 5th slot. That would be...
But you're pretending that Joaquin Phoenix isn't a shoe.
I am. You know what? I just saw Joker. Joaquin Phoenix is very good at running as Joker. I'll give him that.
You're like, that's running in a movie. And the nominees are...
He would win. He would handily win. He's so good. It's a very physical performance, and it's obviously... It's one of those effortful things, but I'm not sure, is it good or is it just effortful? So
yeah.
I just saw the movie, so I'll sit with it for a few days.
Yeah. There's not a lot of running for the best actor. I was just going to make a joke about the other nominees, but a lot of them are very sedate.
Yeah, they don't run.
Performances.
Even though Adam Driver... opens up his arm with a knife.
Yeah, he sort of
spoiler.
Just collapses on the floor.
Yeah.
Yeah, and everybody else is like sort of just sitting around.
So before
just
we
sitting
move
around having their drama for breakfast, lunch, and dinner.
Especially De Niro. Before we move on, let's make a bold prediction. If you said earlier it's Brad versus Al, who will win? I know you don't like to talk about winners this early, but...
I really don't. My suspicion is that Brad's going to win.
Yeah.
Because it's going to be a way to honor the movie, which I don't know why people think it's going to win Best Picture. I don't think it's going to win Best Picture. But I think they're going to want to give it something big and Oscar for Brad Pitt for acting, which he has not yet won, would be... a fun way to honor the movie.
Yes. I agree with you about Brad. But don't you think there is something about Quentin Tarantino being this great iconoclast director, having never won anything but screenplay, even though he won it twice, and maybe people would want to give him Best Picture? Isn't that a factor?
I mean, maybe. But I actually think he's more likely to win Best Director. Mm-hmm. Sorry, Bong Joon-ho fans. I'm absolutely a nut for Parasite, but I also don't think... I think people assuming he's going to win because of all the fervor for Parasite are maybe jumping the gun a little bit.
Okay.
Because we don't even know how... Like, Parasite, in order for him to win, I think it would need to be a big deal at the Oscars and not just, like, the foreign film with, like, 4 nominations. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Because we've seen before, like, even Crouching Tiger had, like, 10 nominations, and Ang Lee didn't win Best Director.
That's true. And that was a surprise that he didn't win.
So I do think there's resistance, just as we saw with Roma. I think there's still resistance in the top categories for subtitled pictures. I could be wrong.
Yeah,
I have been wrong before. Newsflash. But I do suspect. I think it could be a sentimental Oscar for Scorsese for Best Director, or a career Oscar for Quentin.
Mm-hmm.
And neither of those, I think, are at all implausible.
Okay.
So I'm not willing to say Bong Joon-ho is going to win, but I do think he's getting nominated easily.
Well, that's amazing, because he deserves to.
Yeah. But I really want to move Pedro up my chart, so something needs to happen with that campaign.
You know what? I believe that Pedro will get nominated. I just think he is the sort of director who is known all over the world and respected and loved, and he made this movie about being a director, about... that is more obvious than Tarantino or Scorsese about the things that he is in touch with, about what means being a director in late life means. It's more obvious about those themes than those other people, and I think that he will get nominated. And he's been working it. Every day I see pictures of him in L.A.
Yeah. He must have rented a nice condo or something there. Yeah, he's there for a bit.
If Paul Pavlikovsky can get in for Cold War, so
yeah.
He would. He is loved in the Academy, and he has been for 2 decades.
Yes. So we should probably talk about other movies.
Yes. You saw Terminator, Dark Fate. Is that what
it's called? I did. You should ask me questions. You're like, do I have to?
Yes. I think this movie, like, I was... You know, before we started recording, I said to Nathaniel, by the time we release this, everybody would have forgotten about that movie. It's already flopped.
It just came out. It's like literally this is its first weekend.
This is what happens. People talk about the movies before they are released. Once they're released, they're just like, let's move on. Especially if there is no, like, sticking topic in the movie. So yeah. What is a sticking topic for this movie, since you've seen it?
I mean, that's the problem with it, right? It's a nostalgia trip, just like so many sequels and spin-offs and reboots. Like, because the big hook is that Linda Hamilton and Arnold Schwarzenegger are both back.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really the same plot that it's always been. It's just now it's like a little more, it's trying to update itself. Like, okay. I don't want to do spoilers, but it's definitely...
Oh, please, you can spoil this movie.
Let me just say that it's definitely aware of how people's opinions about gender roles have changed over the years, and it's definitely aware of the future is female and all of the,
so that's
the way.
Good.
Yeah, but I'm just saying that's good. But it's also, you know, when movies do it in a commercial aspect, sometimes it feels like a little like they're playing the game. It's not something mm-hmm. deeply felt. It's like, oh, we have to make it, you know, more pro-woman, you know what I'm saying? Yeah. Like, it doesn't feel, like, organic to the material, even though there's no reason it shouldn't, because Linda...
it's always been about Sarah Connor.
Yeah. So it feels, like, a little forced, you know, to... Because, like, there's this thing where she, within the movie, where she doesn't quite get... She's not the target this time, so I'll just say that because it's clear from the beginning of the movie. You know, before she's always been the target. She's not the target this time, so she's like helping to rescue the girl who is.
Is Mackenzie Davis the new Terminator?
Sort of. This is the only real twist that they did is that she's sort of human, but sort of a Terminator.
Oh, wow.
Ooh.
So who's the Terminator?
The Terminator is Gabriel Luna.
Oh, okay.
And as I said on my tweet, that really should have gone viral. I don't know why it didn't. The fact that he's the very first Terminator not to get an ass shot is homophobia.
That
and
is homophobia.
Stick by
I
that.
Agree. I have no intention of seeing that film, but okay, yes, I agree.
They actually do one of those Austin Powers, you know, the comedy of covering up people's nudity.
Oh, my God, really? Wow.
They actually have a scene where he turns away from the camera, so you would have been the ass shot that's in every Terminator movie. And they actually put something blocking your view of his ass.
That is homophobia. You are right.
I'm just like, he's so beautiful. Like, really, you won't get us an ass shot when there's been, what, 7 movies now and they always do this? Like, it's a tradition. It's a trope. It's like, you know, having an episode of the old Wonder Woman series where she doesn't spin and change clothes. Like, you can't do it. It's just part of the material. It's like, I don't know. It's like Batman not having a bat cave. Like, you just don't. You have to, there has to be certain elements that make it what it is, you know?
Yeah. And I can't believe there's been 7 Terminator movies. There's only one great film, which is the James Cameron T2. And I can't believe they made 6 other ones. Like, just
I don't even remember the number, but there's a lot. Plus, there's like 2 television series, I think.
Yeah, I'm just like, just put it to bed. Like, I can't believe we're still making Terminator movies. Literally, the James Cameron one is the only good one.
I would argue the first one's really good, too. But that's also James Cameron.
Yeah.
The first two are really good. And for whatever reason, I'm invested. It's kind of like my Tarzan thing. You know, everybody knows that whatever. For whatever reason, I like Tarzan movies.
Yeah, I know you're really invested. I tried to dissuade you twice from talking about it, but you insisted.
But, you know, like, you know how it is. Like, you get... For whatever reason, you get invested in certain things, and it's like, even if you know it's bad, it's like, I guess it's a guilty pleasure. Like, I like Terminator movies, even though they're often bad.
Okay, so what did you like about this one? So let's put this one to bed. What else did you like about it?
Oh, Mackenzie Davis, who is, like, I don't, watch a lot of TV shows, so I know she was really popular for Catch,
Holt and Catch, something like that.
Yeah, something like that. But I didn't really know her outside of movies, so I'm still getting to know her as an actress, and I thought she was, she was so great on Tully recently, and mm-hmm. so I was like excited to see what she would do in this genre, and she was completely convincing as like an action heroine.
Oh, wow, that's fantastic.
I was really into her. So she's sort of like an altered human, where in this new version of the apocalyptic future, you know, they've learned to augment humans so that they can fight Terminators. So she's sort of half cyborgy, you know.
Great. Good for her. And hopefully this will lead to a bigger career.
She was amazing. But otherwise, yeah, it was complete retread. It was like all the same story beats, you know. Huge action set pieces where you're like, oh, how did they do that? You know, it's really forgettable, unfortunately. Quickly, did we talk about Harriet last week?
I think we did. Briefly, when we talked about Best Actress, and basically we were both kind of meh on it.
Yeah. I'm sad about it still. I do wonder if it's going to... I haven't looked at the box office charts yet this weekend, but it seems like it might do well.
Yeah, I haven't looked either, so... But, you know, my one thing that I said in a tweet is if you gave hours of your life to watch Darkest Hour, The Theory of Everything, and all these other great man biopics that Focus Features has released, you know mm-hmm. what? You have time for Harriet Tubman.
That's probably a good point. That's a good point. I did see in your tweet. That is a good point. I wish the movie were better, though, because I was so rooting. Because I have been rooting for Casey Lemons to return for so long as a director that I was just kind of like, oh. But anyway, you can't have everything.
Yeah, and I also just let's link to the Vanity Fair review by Cam Collins, who actually is the only critic who found different things in the movie that nobody else has noticed. So
okay.
He is a fan of Casey Lemons, and he sort of found the through line with her other movies. And it's a very interesting read if you like his bio and if you want to just read something different about Harriet.
Yes. So we will link up to that. So go read that if you're curious. And I think Merchad is right that if you generally see the biopics that are up for Oscars, you should make time for this one. Maybe you'll like it better than I did. I know that's not a very, like, could you imagine that on a blurb? If you saw these other ones, you should probably see this.
Yeah, I know. That's not going to get anybody.
And it should have, like, a little emoticon with, like, the shrug yes. on the blurb poster.
Unfortunately, it is kind of a shrug movie, yeah.
Oh.
But let's close it. Do you still think Cynthia's going to get in? Because I think she probably will not.
I think... You don't think she will?
I do not. I think I think we'll have a surprise fifth nominee. I'm just not sure who.
So we're agreeing Renee, Scarlett, Charlize, and Saoirse are all in? Is that what we're saying?
I'm not so sure about Charlize. I haven't seen the movie, but we'll see. I think three are in, Renee, Scarlett, and... Renee Scarlett and Saoirse are in. And then we have Charlize.
Two spots open.
Yeah, Charlize, Cynthia, Alfrey, and Lupita. And Awkwafina. Of those five,
yeah.
Two will get in.
Interesting. Okay, so I'm not as positive that Saoirse will get in.
Okay.
So my three that I think I feel very confident about are Renee Scarlett and Charlize. Mm-hmm. But, of course, I'm rooting for Lupita and Alfrey.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
It'll be interesting to see how it turns out. I do think Cynthia's getting in, though.
Okay.
It's
such a great part. It's such a great part. And she actually, if there is a reason to see this movie, it's her performance, because she rises above... The material she writes is definitely doing so much more than the other actors, but that's because it's a great part, and she is a great actor.
Mm-hmm. It wouldn't be... She won't make my list, is what I'm saying, but...
Yeah, she won't make mine either. Yeah.
But I think she's in, which, you know, it's frustrating to me because she wouldn't make my list, and I see some of the people who I think are right almost there, yeah. who I think should absolutely, I think Lupita Nyong'o, for example, who I currently am not predicting, I absolutely 100% think in a sane world she would be in the best
She's
actress
campaigning,
list this year.
Though. She is doing the work. I think she might be in.
Yeah. But that is an example of someone just really transcending the genre and the part and just like really being creative and doing like really memorable work. So I'm hoping that people remember that and don't think, oh, but it's this weird horror movie, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, horror performances do get nominated sometimes. Like I find like the internet discourse a little unresearched about this. People are like, oh, they don't like horror movies. Horror actually has more acting nominations than you know. If you really go back through time, it definitely has more than like fantasy, sci-fi, adventure movies.
Yeah, I mean, this is just the Toni Collette effect. It's just people can't think right. beyond last year.
Yeah. So I don't think the horror. I don't think they dislike horror as much as people think they do. But I still think because it's like an early release and they have more traditional roles available to them, like Harriet Tubman and Megyn Kelly, like and Judy Garland, like biopic performances, essentially. I do think since they have those traditional options, they're more likely to go there. But that's always my complaint about the Oscars. Sorry, blah, blah.
So thank you for listening, and tell us in the comments, what do you think of Best Supporting Actor, and do you think it's Brad versus Al, or who do you think is a spoiler?
And what are your five for Best Actress right now? It's funny how every podcast comes back to Best Actress in the
yes,
end.
That's what the people want. That's what we want. Let's just do it.
That's what we give them. All right. We'll talk again next week.